everyone. Thank you for being here with us today. So as you're seeing, there's like a lot of, there is not a lot of us, so it's going to be a very intimate reading. It's going to be great. So we're going to start and go ahead with presentations. So we're super happy to see you here today. My name is Zola Shishmintseva-Kondamambu. I am a curator, cultural worker of Slavic and Congolese background, and I'm also a member of Beyond the Post-Soviet, which is a collective of artists, thinkers, and researchers working and looking at the experiences and the spaces known as post-socialist and post-Soviet through a decolonial lens.
Hello, everyone. I am Iris Wodraogo, a French podcast journalist and trainer in podcasts. I am working on racism, discrimination, and colonization. I recently co-written an audio docu-series about slavery reparations and the relationship between France and its former Caribbean colonies. I am also one of the spokespersons of the AJAR, Association des Journalistes Antiracistes et Racisés, a French organization launched in 2023 with 200 members that aims to end racism in French media.
So the reading that we are presenting you with today is titled Archives, Ties, and Ideas, and it's composed of four texts with authors as diverse as cultural workers, researchers, or poets from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ukraine, Palestine, and Kazakhstan, but also people from indigenous communities based in Northern Americas. The reading will be followed by a screening of Quinquina Diaspora from French-Egyptian artist Samir Lagouati Rachouane. The works presented today were selected because of their abilities of thinking through the decolonial lens, but beyond their own coloniality. And the text and the screening are tightly tied together by a constant wish and a question of asking where and what coloniality has left us with.
We would like to address our support and solidarity with all the countries that Zola has talked about. And we want this reading to be a time for you to reflect on their fights and to think with us about their situations. September 27, 2019. Dear Matt, I began this letter in Niluzahan, Rabbit City, a white-dominated settlement sitting at the base of Hey Sapa, the Black Hills, our sacred mountains. More than 50 indigenous nations maintain historical ties to this place, a land stolen from us to mine gold, a metal to us that had no intrinsic value. This is our Alcott's. For Lakotas, we call it the heart of everything that is. From space, the outline of the mountains looks like a human heart. The stories tell us humanity began here, shaped from the dirt, which is red like our blood. And Scott Momaday, a Kiowa author, once wrote that his grandmother's stories of this landscape lay like memory in her blood. Confined to the reservation most of her life, she had never visited Hey Sapa, but recounted her people's history of this place. Yesterday, I read an article about the migratory birds that fly into Gaza. The quails enter and live, if not captured by the hungry, doing what many Gazans can't. They enter and leave the world's largest open-air prison camp. The UN predicts Gaza will be uninhabitable by next year, 2020. Was it habitable this year? Last, yours, Nick.
September 29th, 2019. Dear Nick, I often feel ashamed exploring the causes of people in other parts of the world. I am confronted with several narratives of my humble knowledge cannot help me dive into the right narrative. Of course, there could be several legitimate narratives for the struggling people, but it's always that colonial complicit narrative that stands out. The protection of knowledge is grounded in these mainstream narratives that the narrative of the people's struggle is buried. To build a global network of solidarity and struggle, we must build a radical system of knowledge. Our communication should be rooted in the same system. And that's when our solidarity will be impactful and meaningful. Otherwise, it is not enough that we say we are in solidarity with the struggle of people here and there. We cannot defeat an enemy that speaks a common language by using their language. Language is powerful enough to dictate the limits of our thoughts and action. Best, Matt. October 24, 2019. Dear Nick, I write to you from Beit Safafa. My favorite time of the year here, the Holy Harvest season. I am already warming up for it. This season is more than just olives we pick or the gathering. It is a season where we commit to the land, for the collective ownership of the land. The Zionist has been confiscating lands for decades now, and especially farmers' lands. Or they could target the people's connection to the land with economic policies that will force them to change their lifestyles. This has been going on for so long. If any time is a good time, this could also be the best time to start. We need to start working towards the liberation. As oppressed nations, the colors of our chains are the same. Our shackles have the same ring to the ear as we struggle through his life. And although within that same structure of oppression, some of us are more privileged than others, it is the same fight. We either fight it together or there is no point in the fight. The enemy is more organized than ever. Best, Matt.
November 27th of 2019. Dear Matt, I am writing from Albuquerque. I am sorry that I've been unable to write. This time of year is difficult. Is it not the downtimes that define revolutions and revolutionaries? The violence feels cold, slow, and isolating. It's a low point in the movement for us here. The days are getting much shorter. When we were in Palestine, it felt like a big Indian reservation. They told us it was a prison, so we believed them. It's when we destroyed the reservations in our minds that they began to shoot at us and slander us as hostiles, militants, and terrorists. But these are not prisons or merely occupied territory. These are our homelands. We belong here. I look forward to meeting you on the land again, amongst the olive groves. I describe the beauty of Palestine to my aunt. The smell of the sea breeze, the distance to the ocean measured not in miles, but in checkpoints. She began to cry at the thought of smelling an ocean, but not being able to see it or to feel the sand beneath your toes. At that moment, she understood Palestine. It may be a light breeze, a slight smell of freedom for now, but forecast point to an oncoming storm. Sincerely, Nick.
December 2nd, 2019. Dear Nick, a friend told me the other day about his visit to the Kanaki. He spoke of actions the Kanak took to reclaim their lands from the French colonials since 1980s. And this got me thinking that one of our shortcomings in Palestine is our ignorance about these specific actions by the indigenous people in lands across the ocean. We unfortunately construct narrative about what we think those natives aspire for. Many even think that their struggle to reclaim the land, and often they are brought up as an example of what we try to do. This is unfortunate. We do to the narrative of the others what exactly is done to ours. Best, Matt.
December 3rd, 2019. Dear Matt, the storm is blowing in. Land reclamation is tricky business. After all, it is illegal by definition. There is nothing romantic about illegality. Sincerely, Nick. The extract that you've just heard are from a correspondence entitled Working Towards Indigenous Liberation from Turtle Island to Palestine, written by Nick Estes and Matt Mousley and published in 2019 in the Funambulist.
Being Central Asian in 2023 means being classified in a multitude of both geographical and political units, neither of which fully grasping our complex identities. In fact, be it a post-socialist bloc, former Soviet states groups, global South, or global East countries, Turkic, or more generally Asian world, none of the mentioned can truly grant ourselves an adequate representation. This signifies that not only all forms of identitarianism are fake, but also that our rich heritage and our strategic geographical position provided us with an incredibly flexible identity, which goes beyond any essentialization.
Being Central Asian in 2023 means permanently struggling with our authoritarian governments for having the bare minimum when it comes to human rights and dignity. Policing us, they never succeed at breaking our will.
Being Central Asian in 2023 means being constantly menaced by the expansion politics and insatiable imperial appetite of the neighboring terrorist state.
But being Central Asian in 2023 does not mean being trapped in this victim of colonialism state at all. No, it means quite the opposite. Realizing what was lost and what was its price, and that probably there was collaborationism and harm caused also by the locals, not only by the outsiders, but eventually taking agency in constructing a better future. Being Central Asian in 2023 means quite probably being at risk to access drinking water in the following decades. It also means to breathe polluted air without the official authorities even caring about it.
The extracts that we've just shared with you are from an article called What Does It Mean to Be Central Asian Today? Written by Dilda Ramazan in May 2023 for Ruyo Journal.
Story 3, Untitled. I said, everything I know about the East, I've learned in the West. Ruta said, I'm different, but not different enough.
Introduction. It is only after a story has been told that we can challenge it, look for flaws, inaccuracies, and imperfections. The history of a story is always defined by its first narrator, because to begin talking about something, it must first be uttered.
This text is about the right to name and tell a story, and therefore to be heard. It's about the right to set the vector of conversation and thus determine the prospects for its development. And yes, all of this is directly related to the history of Eastern European art.
Story 2. So who is the other? The other is not who, but what. It's a function. Its existence is not permanent and not complete, but rather fragmented. It appears at times when there is a need for it and disappears when that need ends. Its purpose is to illustrate, to be an example.
The other is also a broken rule. It exists outside the boundaries of my established norms and cannot be explained by the categories sufficient to explain me. For this reason, the other endangers the very basis of my and your existence, but at the same time becomes the object of my and your fascination.
Story 1, geography lesson. 7 rules. Teacher, dear students, please find Eastern Europe on the map. You have 3 minutes. Go. To put it shortly in context for you, in this text, the author, Asya Tizar, a Ukrainian art historian and curator, imagines a fictional and surrealist conversation between a teacher and its pupils on what is Eastern Europe.
Western art museums. Dear teacher, I know the answer. According to the index of work in my repositories, Eastern Europe includes the ex-Soviet Union. So it's Russia, the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, the Caucasian countries, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan.
German art museums. Dear teacher, I have the same list, but also Poland.
Geography. But that's absurd. You've literally named more than 10 different parts of the world under one title. How can Central Asia be Eastern Europe?
Teacher, guess we have a problem. If geography is confused, let's ask history. What's Eastern Europe?
19th century. I've honestly never heard of anything like this.
20th century. Sorry, guess I'm sick. Can I go home? Teacher. Oh, okay. Maybe let's ask those who are on the list what they think about it.
Political history. Well, Eastern Europe isn't really a geographical term. I mean, something for sure geographically lies to the east of Europe, but that's not the point. Eastern Europe is a political term, and it was invented during the Cold War in the contest between communist and capitalist blocs.
Cold War. See? I told you I know better. So, Eastern Europe consists of several socialist states, which during the Cold War were considered the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union. As it collapsed, Russia inherited the rights of the Soviet Union, and the newly independent countries around it inherited the status of its sphere of influence. Comment. When you hear sphere of influence, try to think colonies. Therefore, before 1991, it was Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and after it became Eastern Europe and Russia. See? Very easy.
Logic. Wait, so Eastern Europe is not a geographical area, but a term invented for identifying Russia's priorities in international policy.
Geography. Okay, let's imagine just for a moment that this is true. Then, where does this potential Russia-Eastern Europe end?
Western Europe. Right at the point where Western Europe begins.
Geography. And where is that exactly?
Western Europe. Right at the point where European civilization starts.
Logic. Did anyone notice the switch from Western Europe to Europe? It's not really my business, but I'm just curious. What are the ways to prove that any of these are Europe?
European Union. It depends on the situation. But trust us, we are managing this process. We are very flexible and know exactly when there are enough proofs.
I mean, sure. So, geography. So there is no objective criteria. You just decide according to your own will and needs.
European Union. Well, we do believe that both our will and needs are very objective.
Logic. Wait, so on one hand, Eastern Europe is a term invented for identifying Russia's sphere of influence, colonies, and on the other, to mark the fluid borderline of Western Europe, which exists to highlight the difference between us, Europe, civilization, and them, not Europe, barbarians?
Story 4. The narrator with the limited vocabulary. What we refer to be the history, in this case of art, is in fact the history of Western European art. Although it is silently acknowledged as the gold standard against which we measure all other art histories, any attempt to publish a book titled Western European Art would be rather seen as an overview. We will know it is a simplification. Yet, bookstore shelves are filled with titles like African art, Islamic art, or Eastern European art, which are expected to provide sufficient information about their subjects, defining what it is and how it should be interpreted.
What I'm trying to highlight here has nothing to do with any specific country. The term Eastern Europe, or as previously said, African or Islamic art itself is the main issue. We pretend it detonates a culture region, but in fact, we use it to mark a sparkle of something that catches the Western eye in a groundbreaking political circumstance.
In this context, this political circumstance, Eastern European is deemed more significant than art itself, as it predetermines how this art should be viewed, treated, and understood. However, nobody whose consciousness has been raised wants to be seen as merely a label, an occasion for a story, or an illustration of an history book.
When we know what we know is a question of power dynamics, of war, a war of narratives. A studied subject leads us to think that it was studied purposefully, that it is deemed more important than others. But everything we know as important was named so by someone at some point. And when I say someone, I'm not at all thinking about Western male scholars and their biases. We are taught to ignore certain stories to make our own more solid. We are also taught to sacrifice some stories to emphasize the importance of others. And some stories are just too complicated. And we don't have the language to tell them, so we give up on them. Like in France, when we talk about race. These stories are extracts from The Role You Made Me Play, about an obvious difficulties of studying Eastern European art, written by Asia Tiza and published on the platform Secondary Archives in 2024.
The good soil we owned. When I move to kill the man, he kneels, palms gravity, like he belongs to this good earth. Daring to cry, wail, lost his small shop to our son by locals, says he can't leave his son and daughter.
My mom had a son and daughter.
The man isn't here colonially, not to steal and kill, but rent and buy till Kinshasa doesn't smell like me, till the soil becomes our roof. The man says he isn't in story and...
Show me your hands.
He is a brown, maybe two shades lighter than mine. Man.
So small.
Says he's a bottom feeder, just wants a place to work, to feed his son, his daughter, and I release my grip, unearth my limbs, unloving, unhating, just that seat he has, bloodied and whole. That's it, used to be mined.
Portrait of Lubumbashi, DRC. Feces soil, a sad attempt of a sidewalk. A missionary brings Jesus on a cobalt-rich phone. Everyone's broke, but no one is poor enough to die. A rat boards a rocket that erupts in the name of science. A cardboard box can sing. In the right hands, there is too much rain for anything to be permanent. The sun is Lubumbashi's last defensive architect. Cities don't cry when it rains. They cry through the blood of children.
Ask why all this foreign head can't fix the smile of a skull. Why the most violent killer in DRC is a child.
All Congolese got beef with some white man. I'm not different. I'm not really mad, I'm just broke. My skin still shrinks when I see a dog fed a child's survival. In a city this big, family is whoever remembers you smiling. A memory is dangerous when left in a cardboard box. A cardboard box is a machete that hasn't grown up yet. A cardboard box is a home. A city of cardboard boxes is a graveyard.
These poems were written by the Congolese poet Sianga. They were published in the book Congo from the Heavens.
So thank you for listening to us. We wanted to say a few words on the text that we've just shared with you.
The letters were written by Nick Estes, an assistant professor in American studies, born in the Lower Brule Sioux tribe. He is the author of the book Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance, published by Verso in 2019. And by Matt Musley, a Palestinian academic in media studies from Beit Safafa in Jerusalem. In 2018, his research on the Zionist policies against the boycott movement was published by Massart Research Center in Ramallah. The research examined the policies against BDS, as well as explored connections and comparisons between the South African boycott movement and BDS. He is also the co-organizer of the Palestinian Festival of Literature.
So Dilda Ramazan was born and grew up in Kazakhstan. She works as an exhibition curator and is currently studying for a PhD at École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. She also runs the Kalfin Foundation in Kazakhstan and is a member of Mata and Vara Art Collective. And the journal that published her work is Ruyo Journal, an artist-run platform dedicated to fostering critical discourse in the fields of art, film, and theory. Their goal is to contribute to Central Asian discourse and strengthen its presence. Asia Tsizar, formerly known as Asia Senina, is a Ukrainian curator and culturologist. She developed her practice in between art and cultural studies and focuses her interest on Central and Eastern Europe. Her topics of interest include archives, objects and collections, memory, commemoration, and the modes of rethinking the Soviet past. She bases her curatorial work on methods of artistic research and creative storytelling. Currently, Asia is a curator of Secondary Archives, a platform for women artists from Central and Eastern Europe, Ukraine, and Belarus. She works in Warsaw.
And Gracia Sionga Mwamba is a Congolese artist based in California, and the poems you've just heard were published in their first book. They are the co-winner of the Evaristo Prize for African Poetry.
And finally, to start with the second half of our little program and to say a few words this time on the screening of Quinquina Diaspora, which is the film that we're going to show you right after. Quinquina Diaspora is a video work by French and Egyptian artist and performer Samir Lagrotti-Rachouane, who creates narratives from archival work using media such as film, photography, and sculpture. His work explores the politics of space and body, with particular focus on representation of the other, the body, and race in mediated cultural productions and institutional spaces. With a tone oscillating between amusement and vulnerability, he traces marginalized and forgotten histories and explores geographical displacement and linguistic reappropriation as testimony to the systems of domination. So it's the themes of archival work, the other, and the question of race that draw us to Samir's work. For this particular piece, he worked in the archives of Jardin d'Agronomie Tropicale, located in the Bois de Vincennes, that is tied to a very strong piece of French colonial history as being the site of the French colonial exhibitions in 1941. The starting point of the film is an interest in colonial production, natural resources, and their translation as something we all know and perhaps love, cocktail drinks. Whilst working on that topic, he noticed that many plants used in cocktails were medicinal plants. Amongst them, quinquina holds a special place as it was used as medicine on Louis XIV and went on to become an object of power, desire, and display of wealth for the court and other noblemen and women. The need for quinquina became an extractivist one. And since the plant was incompatible with the French climate, the French went above and beyond through their colonial empire to find a place for it to grow. Quinquina Diaspora questions that need and highlights the appeal for some to demonstrate an ownership over our land and talks about our relationships to plants as post-colonial societies, showing us once and for all that topics of ecology and decoloniality can be tied together. But most importantly, that coloniality is at times present right under our noses, but this time mostly in our drinks. Thank you.